So tonight all your questions will be answered. Otherwise you have to wait till the next retreat. Here we go. Dear Ajahn, can you attain the final goal, Nirvana, by both loving kindness and breath meditation? Of course you can. So in other words, if you did loving kindness or breath meditation, it doesn't really matter because that's all a vehicle. Can you get, those of you who come from Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand, can you get back to home on Thai Airways or Malaysian Airways or Singapore Airlines or Qantas? Yeah, you can get on back on any of those aircraft. These are very good vehicles. So loving kindness meditation works because loving kindness is opening the door of your heart to whatever you're experiencing right now, unconditionally. Which means you have to let go. Because real loving kindness, may all beings be happy and well. All beings. May all mind moments be happy and well. So unconditional acceptance. When you unconditionally accept every moment in meditation, you can't do anything. There's nothing to do anymore. That's why that sometimes I've seen some people, they've been mad for such a long time. They love each other so much, they understand each other so well, that they don't need to talk to each other. Or perhaps just they've had an argument, I don't know. But usually, if you know each other, there's no business to be done, because you understand each other perfectly. So there's a sense of stillness there when there's no business to be done. And that's what happens when you have loving kindness. Everything becomes very still, in the peace of embracing with acceptance all things, including this moment. And the same with breath meditation. You all know that breath meditation leads to enlightenment because that was the practice of the Buddha. He did meditation on the breath. And for those of you who think, when is Ajahn Brahm going to talk about Satipatthana? The Buddha said, and you can check this out for yourself, in the Anapanasati Sutta, any person who practices Anapanasati also at the same time fulfills the four Satipatthanas. So, for those who have been watching your breath, you have been doing Satipatthana according to the word of the Buddha. Check that out. Majjhima Nikaya 118, the Anapanasati Sutta. Anyone who does all of the stages of Anapanasati also, at the same time, simultaneously, does the four Satipatthanas. So this is a Satipatthana retreat. Could you be doing mindfulness of the breath? I hope. Some of you will be doing a lot of flat-out meditation. You know what that means? Watching the snore go in. Watching it go out. What is a skillful way to decide when to stop meditating? Are clocks skillful? No, just don't stop meditating. That's the most skillful way. Just carry on all the way to Nirvana. Who cares about time? So in other words, you don't stop the meditation. Sometimes just the meditation stops. It wears out and that's it. Just like the rain comes and then the rain stops. It just stops when according to nature. So it's the same when you meditate. Just meditate and just enjoy. And after a while, it's just time to come out. That's all. So you stop the meditation. If you're having fun, and as they say, wholesome states are increasing and unwholesome states are decreasing, then carry on. But if you find that, you know, the body's getting a bit more painful and the mind is getting a bit restless, it's obviously the time is up. So go and do some walking meditation or do some other type of meditation. So after a while, you get a feel for when it's really a good time to continue on and when it's just the time just to change the posture and do something else. Yeah, well, that's the trouble with people who've heard about what my teacher says and compare it to what I say. But it is true. What he's saying there is sometimes that people are lazy. And so sometimes, oh, I don't feel like meditating today. I feel like watching the TV. I don't feel like meditating today. I'm going to read the newspaper. There's a sort of lazy person who's a person who needs to be prompted to meditate. But I mean, you're not lazy people, are you? No, of course you're not, because you've come a long way to come on this retreat. And you're well motivated, which is why that some of those teachings which any monk or nun or teacher gives, sometimes they're focused on the person. That's why even Ajahn Chah used to say, sometimes I contradict myself, he said, because sometimes it's like I see a person on a bicycle, they're leaning to the left. I say, go to the right. Another day I see another person, they're leaning to the right. So I say, go to the left. And people think that I'm contradicting myself, but I'm just teaching the people. And so for some people you say, yeah, get up early, just if you don't feel like meditating, just meditate. But most people in our modern world, they are work far too hard. You strive too much. You're too much goal-getters. And because of that, that's why you teach people, just to relax a bit. Don't work so hard. And I found that far more successful. However, if you ever, well, maybe it's changed now, but in the old days in northeast Thailand, yeah, they would work hard when there was something to be done, like ploughing the fields or reaping the rice. But after the rice season was over, I've never seen people so lazy as the people in the northeast Thailand. You go past them in the middle of the day, they'll be just laying down in under the shade of the house, and you say, what are you doing? And they're just living. They weren't doing anything useful, just living. Used to say, just being. And they were really, really, really lazy. And so Ajahn Chah had to be really, really strict with his, especially northeast monks, to really push them, to get them to work. At least to get them to meditate, because otherwise they just wouldn't do anything. Not at all, they didn't get jhana inside of the house. They just got even more sleepy. When you talk about gentleness in a meditation, is this a synonym for compassion to oneself and others? Yet gentleness is another type of compassion, but it's a subtlety of mind. When instead of actually grabbing onto your mind with force, you use this very subtle gentleness. So you walk with sensitivity to make sure you don't tread on any, say, snails or any other animals, so you might kill them. You're very, very sensitive and gentle when you go and get your food in the morning. You don't just push your way in front of the line and just grab what you think is yours. You're very, very gentle and soft and even actually patient. These are all parts of being gentle. It's the opposite. The reason why I use the word gentle is because in the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right intention, which is the basis of karma, the three right intentions may cover sankhapa, which is like renunciation, letting go, making peace. The second of the right intentions is the intention of non-ill will, in other words, kindness. And the third one is ahimsa. And many of you know that, ahimsa, non-violence, because it was a word made popular by Gandhi, even though it sort of originated from the Buddha. Ahimsa is non-violence. So you don't do violence to your body, to your mind, to anybody or anything in this retreat. Non-violence is another word for gentleness. And it's amazing just how people can do violence to their body and violence to their mind in a meditation retreat. Pushing yourself through pain. I know that that was sometimes people thought that was a good thing to do. You've got an ache in your knee, push your way through it, don't give in. So you can defeat the pain in your knees by just sitting hour after hour. It doesn't matter how much it hurts, you're just going to push through it. And one of our monks, a contemporary of mine, he's now the abbot of the monastery in England in Harlem, Ajahn Munindo, he tried that. He decided to be a tough guy, so he had aches and pains in his knees when he was meditating, and just sat through it. Had to have a double knee reconstruction. And I always remember that. It's absolutely stupid. What are you doing that for? So, don't push yourself through pain. If you push yourself through pain, very often the pain wins and you have to go to hospital. And don't try and sue the Buddhist Society of Western Australia because you weren't told to do that. So you don't push yourself through pain. You're gentle with the body. In other words, do no violence to the body. So don't force and push the body, because that's what the Buddha tried before he was enlightened. The 6 years of austerity, it does not work. So that's what I mean by gentleness, non-violence. And don't be violent with your speech. Don't be violent with your thoughts towards yourself. Don't be violent towards your mind. Be very kind and gentle to it. Don't go into the mind and say, you've only got one day to go. You're going to stay up tonight because you've been lazy all this week. And you're going to really meditate tonight. Enlightenment or bust. I've got to get enlightenment before I get back to Penang. Otherwise I'm not going to allow myself to go back. So you force yourself. And that's violence. And you know it's violence. It's not what you would do to somebody else, but sometimes you do it to yourself. So the gentleness and the kindness, that's the way of Buddhism. Dear Ajahn, could you please enlarge on the master guru student disciple relationship in the forest monk tradition? Yeah. We have like two rules in our monastery. Rule number one, the abbot is always right. Rule number two, if the abbot is wrong, go back to rule number one. That's right, isn't it, monks? Nah. Oh dear. So the nice thing about in the forest tradition, you are allowed to argue with your teacher. And there's sometimes that people were quite surprised that in Thailand you're not usually supposed to disagree with your teacher, but with Ajahn Chah you could. And when especially Western monks would disagree with him, he would actually sort of say, no, please carry on, because you know, for you Western monks it's great that you're questioning, and for me, he says, it's sharpening my knife. You know, because of you ask these tough questions which Thais would never dare to ask, I really enjoy this because it makes me sharper in my wisdom. So he actually welcomed people to disagree and argue with him. And that was actually quite reassuring and refreshing. That here was a religion, yeah, this was a great monk, but you could still sort of talk and discuss things with him, and he'd respect you for that. So as a teacher myself, the last thing I would want, you know, would be if anything I say, they said, yes, Ajahn Brahm, oh, what great wisdom you have, Ajahn Brahm. And when they go out afterwards and say, what a stupid thing Ajahn Brahm has just said. Because that doesn't help me and it doesn't help you. So, you know, we have this like honesty with a teacher and a student. And they use the word here, the master guru. The guru is a Sanskrit word which in Pali is garu. And they have the word to worship is garu karoti. And it literally means heavy or weighty. And so the teacher is heavy, weighty in many ways. So just being a guru, being weighted. But what is really important is actually the words which your teacher says, they're given extra weight because they come from your teacher. So it doesn't mean they have to be right. But because they come from your teacher, you really consider them carefully. Now this is my teacher, you know. So what he says, I'm not going to give this the same weight as, say, an ordinary person. And that's what we really mean by guru. A person who has extra weight in what they say and what they do. So you really consider it a little bit deeper than other people's words. So that's what we have the master guru in the forest tradition. You can still argue with them, but they're sort of whatever they say, you really take seriously. And that student-disciple relationship, like anything else, that you look after your monks for 5 years, and then they're supposed to go off to learn from other teachers. So you don't attach to your students as if they're your students and don't allow them to go and experience other types of teaching. So the tradition was after 1 year as an anagarika in white, another year as a novice, and a further 5 years as a monk, then they're supposed to be free to go to travel to other monasteries, other parts of the world, seek solitude. So they can get a wider experience, because we all know no matter how great a monk you may be, you're not full in all your aspects of wisdom and practice. There's other monks who are stronger in other things than you are. So by going to visit other monks, other teachers, they begin a much more rounded education as a monk. So I expect and encourage some of my monks, after they finish their 5 years, to go and visit other places. They get a bit more experience. They can always come back here afterwards, but at least they get more understanding experience of what's going on. And then after 10 years, you should have enough experience that, you know, you should start being able to take responsibility to give talks and give teachings yourself. That's the tradition of the forest tradition. You're not really supposed to be a teacher, an abbot, until at least 10 years and maybe even more. First 5 years you stay with one teacher, the next 5 years you go travelling and finding other teachers, and after 10 years you may be able to start off a temple by yourself, but not earlier. Is there a direct enhancement of students' disciples' awakening by his teacher or guru? No, like the Buddha said, the Buddha's only show the way. And it's up for the students to follow that way. So I can't make anybody become enlightened. I can't give some sort of transmission. I can't distill that magic potion into a pill and give you enlightenment pills. Wouldn't it be wonderful, instead of having to sit here for 9 days, just take a pill and then suddenly you get enlightened? I actually thought, because people, I'm not all that sort of well-versed in IT, but people did say you can have these little glasses which give you, what do they call that? Visual reality, yeah. Virtual reality, yeah, because with a virtual reality, I can create a nimitta right in front of you. Really bright, and actually keep it stable for you. You won't have to sort of worry about it, and then you have a big nimitta in front of you. And who knows, that might really help you get sort of into jhanas, at least. No, that's not what you can do. It wouldn't work anyway. You have to do it all for yourself. So the teacher is just to give the inspiration, the encouragement, the teachings. Actually, it's not so much the teachings, because you all know those teachings. You can find those teachings anyway. Give the inspiration, encouragement and motivation. That's perhaps one of the most important things of a teacher. And that's why living with someone like Ajahn Chah, that was really inspirational, motivational, because, you know, you watched him all his time, and he lived what he taught. You know, he didn't sort of behave in another way when no one was watching. And I think many of you know one of the great experiences I had with Ajahn Chah was just before he lost his ability to speak. Now, it must have been about 7 or 8 years. And then I was just hanging out under his hut, and he asked me to go and fetch something from his room. And it was the first time I ever went into my teacher's living quarters. I went to see how he lived. And I was fascinated. All these years I've seen Ajahn Chah. What's his room like? Is it a mess with things all over the place? Is there newspapers or penthouse magazines under the carpet? And what is he like? And when I went inside his room, it was just so inspiring. It's the vision I can never actually get out of my mind. Just an empty room with a straw mat, a wooden pillow, and I think there must be about one robe on a line and a book in the corner, and that was it. That was all the worldly possessions of this great monk, who kings, queens, ministers and generals, very wealthy people, would line up to give him all this stuff. And what did he actually have in his room? Nothing. Now that was a holy monk. That's a real monk. So if you really want to know a monk or a nun's attainments, ask to go into their room. See what they've got. I don't know, I can't remember what I felt. I think it was his robe, I think. Not much in there, it's a good question though. Anyway, whatever it was easy to find. That was great, wasn't it? So sometimes you get sort of a bit disappointed if monks or nuns have lots and lots of possessions. But what do you want them for? The real monk is supposed to have very, very few stuff. And it's much easier having few possessions. You know, going to the airports, just carrying, like, you know, many of you have received me at Singapore or Malaysia or Bangkok. You just got your bowl and my bag, and that's all. So simple. The other monks have got suitcase and this suitcase, and they're overweight. And that's a bit sort of embarrassing when you're overweight as a monk going... So it's great having just few possessions, and actually that's what the Buddha said, be like a bird who's only got the weight of its wings when it travels. And unfortunately that these days the religious figures, they just live too high off the hog. They have too much stuff, So you be careful. Don't offer monks expensive things. Give them simple things. Well, that's where they come from you people just offering too much to monks. Offer it to the temple. Offer it to a retreat center. Offer it to a Buddhist society, but don't offer it to a monk or a nun. So keep us simple. And if so, is there a direct enhancement of students' disciples' awakening by teacher guru? If so, does it result in an everlasting bond between them, as in the Tibetan tradition? No way. As I've told you many times, I'm trying my hardest to get rid of you. I don't want to be bonded to you guys forever. That's why you try and teach someone to be free, not teach them to be dependent. So that idea of a bond between people, that goes completely against the idea of detaching. Like any other teacher in a school, university, college, a teacher's job is to make the student independent of them. So they don't need to come to class ever again. So it is true, a student, whether it's a Buddha, a great monk, great nun, their job is to try and get rid of disciples, not to accumulate more. To make you so independent, you know exactly what the teacher knows, maybe even more, so you can be free. So there's no everlasting bond. So, yeah? Yeah? Did the disciples of Ajahn Chah take turns in looking after him? It was out of respect to Ajahn Chah, but also just out of a wonderful practice to be able to be with the person who's sick. Because actually sometimes that's reminding you that one day you'll be like that and be sick. So looking after the sick, looking after the dying, going to funerals is always a good reflection of what's going to happen to you. So it is Dharma. It's like the death contemplations. That's one of the contemplations we're supposed to do. Imagine ourselves dead. We actually do a ceremony like that in Thailand. You lie down and you pretend to be dead. We put this white cloth over you. We chant the funeral chants. And then after we do the funeral chants, you're supposed to lie perfectly still. And then we do some other chants, like the live chants. And then we take the cloth off and you've been reborn. And the idea is all your bad karma from the past, all the bad luck dies with the old body, and you get reborn in this life, fresh and free. It's a crazy ceremony, but apparently in Bangkok, one monastery is making a fortune out of this, because they actually got real coffins and they get you to lie in them, and the monks do the funeral chanting and a bit of water and stuff, and then you get out of it afterwards, like reborn with all your bad luck dead. It's really stupid, but nevertheless, people get into that. It's amazing how superstitious people can be. And sometimes the superstition which people have, things like, I've heard this, that some people say that if you're on a retreat, you can't accept money. Monks can never accept money, but your 8 precepts doesn't mean you can't accept money. Of course you can accept money. Or that, if a woman is having menses, having a period, she can't go into a temple. That's absolutely stupid. That means that the nuns would always have to leave once a month and find other accommodation. The whole thing is absolutely stupid. But these superstitions are still there. And they're one of the worst superstitions. They have this superstition, and they've seen this in Malaysia and Singapore, that when you're dead, or just dying, and the monks go and chant over you, then afterwards the monks touch your head and touch your feet to see which is the warm part last. And if the last part which is warm is your feet, it means your soul has gone out of the feet and it's gone to a bad rebirth. It's gone down into some hell realm or ghost realm. Because that's the last part of the body which is hot is your feet. That means the soul has gone out through the feet. But if the last part of your body which is hot is your head, then it means the chanting has worked. It means that the soul has gone out through the head, and that means it's gone high up into heaven realm. Now, there's a few doctors here. You know that the last part of the body which is hot before you die is always the head. Because the brain has to get the last bit of blood and energy. It's the last part which is preserved. It's never the case you have hot feet when you're dead. It's always hot head. But people believe that so much that the monks go in there doing the chanting, say, yeah, it's worked again. See, the head was the last part which is hot. Please give me a few more ang paos. It's a complete scam. So don't believe that sort of stuff. So don't be too superstitious. How do I get into that? I don't know. But anyway, we'll talk about gentleness in meditation. It's a synonym for compassion. It's amazing just how one question goes really leads off to some amazing things. But anyway, yeah, gentleness is a synonym for non-aggression. You'll talk about letting go in the process of dying. Here we go. What about sudden death, e.g. accident, where there is no chance of meditation to let go? Of course there is. So you've got sudden death. But you don't just go unconscious. There you are, dead. And you're floating outside of your body. And you see your body down there. You say, ah, isn't this brilliant? Got rid of this body before I had to go to an old people's home, because getting old is not a very nice prospect. It's much better to die young. It is. So if you have an accident, say, whoopee, I died young. So they just let go of the body. So instead of being shot, if you find yourself floating out of your body, you've had a sudden death, what should you do? Make peace. Be kind, be gentle. Just allow everything to settle down. Stop trying to control the death process. It's not you, it's just a process. So just stop it. Just let go. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. And see how still you can be. See if you can stop. And if you can stop, really stop, big time stop, there's a good chance you won't get reborn again. But if you make peace and be kind, be gentle, at least that type of mind, where would that get reborn? In the realm of the peaceful beings, in the realm of the kind ones, in the realm of the gentle ones, the heavenly realms. But if you get dying, I'm dead, then you get... then you get reborn in the realm of the frightened beings. So you actually make your rebirth. So be kind, make peace, be gentle when you die. And then exactly what you've learned here will keep you in good stead to have a good rebirth, or who knows, no rebirth. That's the way. Meditation is just practice in how to die. Did you really drink your own urine? I guess it's better than drinking someone else's. That's the point. If you did, then I'll try it when I have my next dinner party to gross out my guests. It might cut down on food costs. You'll certainly get rid of your guests quickly too. Now that was just when we were monks in Thailand. We got this book, I think it's a guy called Armstrong, who said, if you drink your urine, you have really good health. And it's very difficult in Thailand, because there's no doctors, no medicine in that part of Thailand, because very poor monks. So it's great to be able to try and do something to improve your health. And so many of us started drinking our own urine. It's really nice in the early morning. Nice and warm and salty when you can't have a cup of coffee. It's the next best thing. And it's also just to get rid of that idea of something disgusting. Because there's nothing wrong with it. It's biologically very good. It hasn't got any diseases in it because it's all been purified through your system. So it's actually a very, very healthy thing to drink. So you know, many monks did that. I did that for many years. And the only reason I stopped was when I came back to Australia. I think it was the first summertime. We were working so hard building up Bodhidharma Monastery, because I was working so hard and sweating so much. You know, in the morning, it was hardly any urine came out because it all sweated out. And so that basically, I lost my supply of urine. So I just gave up for a while and never took it up again. But you know, what's gross about it? It's your urine. It comes from your body, so put it back in again. It's what better way of recycling? Yes? Yeah.
First part, you get the second part. And the first part's got a lot of endurance.
Yeah, now we've dragged the whole lot. We're tough guys. We're quality. Gee. Are you? Namby pamby cream puff, speak the second puff. Real tough guys. It's easy. It's just, again, it's just a mental thing. You think it's gross. You think it's going to taste nasty. But if you just start drinking, it's quite pleasant. It is. Try it. Okay, tomorrow morning. I'll tell Bianca to put it out for breakfast. For the past few days, I have something become very aware of my body, to the point where I can feel blood pumping through the whole body all the time. At first, this was a very interesting thing that happened. However, it doesn't stop. It's gotten to the point where I cannot sleep. What's happening? And is there a way to stop it, because I'm getting very tired? Okay, sometimes when your mindfulness gets quite strong, you can become aware of the body. And that awareness of the body is magnified. In other words, you become more aware of the body than in usual consciousness. In the same way, I'm saying, you're just getting more powerful mindfulness. The food tastes more delicious. You can see more colors in the sky or in the forest or in the floor. You're just getting a more intense mindfulness. And that mindfulness, if it does go on to the body, it can actually get you almost like stuck in body awareness, which is a bit too strong. So the way to overcome that is, number one, sort of move the attention away from the body to something like the breath, first of all, and just focus on the breath and not part of the body. Or do something more physical to take your mind off that one part of the body. It's called substitution in Buddhism. Now do some loving kindness meditation, and just do some walking, or just have a walk in the forest. And that sort of stuff will actually take your attention away from that one area, put it onto another area, without losing the strength of your mindfulness. But what really is the problem is that sometimes, instead of actually following those instructions and eventually going onto the breath and just focusing on the breath to the exclusion of all other parts of the body, sometimes it's just we're too slack and sloppy, and the attention of the body hasn't really disappeared when we get these high energy states. And so the energy, instead of staying with the breath or staying in the mind, just flows to other parts of the body. So actually you haven't really let go of the body enough. You're just still with the body when the high energy states come. If you do it properly, that when those high energy states come, it just stays with the breath. It becomes so beautiful and so lovely, you can't feel any other part of the body. And then the breath disappears and all that energy is kept inside the mind and can't go into the body. But a lot of people have got what we call leaky buckets. So instead of the mind containing all that energy, it leaks out into the body. And sometimes people get energy rushes, or they get parts of the body which have heightened awareness, and they have these little difficulties. But don't worry about it. It's almost the end of the retreat. When you go home, all of that energy will dissipate, unfortunately, and you'll catch up on your sleep. So that's really all it is. But when you are sleeping, when you rather do lay down, many people have a very easy job to sleep. So sometimes a person who doesn't have an easy job to sleep, sometimes it's because they're controlling too much. There was a time when I found it difficult to sleep, and so I just lay down on the bed, and I used classic reverse psychology. I said, I don't want to go to sleep. Because to me, the bed was the most comfortable position I could ever be in. So often you spend hours and hours sitting meditation with sore bottom, sore knees. But in the bed, you've got this wonderful soft mattress, you've got all these cushions. Aren't you cozy in bed? When you wake up in the morning, isn't it just the most beautiful place to be? You don't really want to get out of bed in the morning. So there you are in bed, having a wonderful time. What do you want to go to sleep for and miss all of this? So that's why I convinced myself, I don't want to go to sleep, because it was so cozy, I want to enjoy every moment of being in the softest, coziest, warmest place in the whole monastery, in my bed. And of course, when I didn't try to go to sleep, I'd go fast asleep. It just told me that just the trying and controlling was what's stopping me going to sleep. And sometimes I was so afraid, if I don't go to sleep soon, it's going to be 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, and I've got to give a talk tomorrow morning, I'll be tired. And that fear, I had to get to sleep, I had to get to sleep, I had to get to sleep. That also keeps you awake. So it doesn't matter whether you get 1 hour sleep or 10 hours sleep. You can always survive. So when you don't worry, and when you're not afraid, when you don't try so hard to go to sleep, 99% of the cause of insomnia is taken away. It's just the attitude we have to being awake or to being asleep. That's the problem. But the common way of going to sleep for insomniacs is do the body sweeping meditation. Start with the toes, relax the toes, but nice and peaceful. Then go to the feet. Then that's really nice and peaceful. You relax the feet to sweep through the body. Usually before you even get to your tummy, you're fast asleep. And if that doesn't work, there are many people. I remember this girl in Malaysia came up to tell me. She said, every evening before I go to sleep, I listen to one of your talks. And I always have a very, very deep sleep. So that's the other way. Listen to a boring talk by until you're fast asleep. There's many ways of falling asleep. So I think that the reason is that your mindfulness is very strong and it's actually just gone too much into the body where it should have really gone into the breath and into the mind. But don't worry about it. Transfer the mindfulness to something else and it will soon just dissipate and disappear. Is Bodhidharma considered a forest tradition? Yes. Does monks there need to eat boiled frog? How is the forest tradition followed in the present days? Oh, it's very rare to find a good forest monastery these days. The Bodhidharma monastery over the road is not like it was in the good old days when I was a young monk. Oh, monks have it so easy these days. I remember when I was a young monk, I used to sleep on a door. And that door had ribs in it, not like these flat doors they have these days. It was one of these doors like your front door of your cottage, all ribs in it. And it had a hole in the middle. And under that hole in the middle, the wind would come up and keep you awake. But that hole in the middle was actually quite useful sometimes because I didn't want to go out of bed to go to the toilet. I could always have... I never did that. I thought about it a few times. I was tough in those old days. But no, that's what sometimes you say. But no, whether it's austere or not austere, it doesn't really matter. It's a monk's attitudes. And a forest and monastery... Technically, it has a definition. It has to be at least 1 kilometre from the nearest house. So Bodhidharma Monastery satisfies that condition. However, that's not really just the reason why it's called a forest monastery. A forest monastery is because it's simple and it keeps a sort of simple way of living. So our forest monastery, we've made a very strong point of not having internet at that monastery. And you know that sometimes I get a lot of pressure from our Buddhist Society committee. Let's get internet so that we can send all the details of the next committee meeting to you, and so you know that we can send emails to you and stuff like that. But we've made a very strong point. No, we're not going to have internet at that monastery. We'll have internet at this retreat centre, but not at Bodhidharma Monastery. Because internet can be very useful, but it gets monks too involved in other things, and it's not really the forest monastery anymore. So we try and keep it as simple as possible. Simple, practical, as best we possibly can. So that monks can spend more time meditating than they do have to do administrating. And also, a forest monastery, if it's a forest monastery, it should be for monks. Or a forest monastery for nuns. So please excuse us if you want to come and stay at Bodhidharma Monastery and there's not enough accommodation. That's done on purpose. Otherwise it becomes another lay centre. And the whole focus would be on teaching lay people and the monks would get neglected. The monks are a very special case. The nuns are extremely special. And they need a place where they feel welcome. They feel comfortable. Their place so they can train. And if too many other lay people, lay men or lay women, come to stay, the whole focus changes. A good example of that, every Wednesday night, except if I'm here overseas, I give a talk at Bodhidharma Monastery. And it's a very strict rule, even though that many of you are good meditators, if you're not staying at that monastery, you cannot go and listen to that talk. You cannot travel from Perth and just go and listen. You have to be staying there, otherwise you can't listen to that talk. And the reason I do that is because if there's too many lay people there, I give a lay person's talk. I just can't help myself. It's just, you're talking to the people then. The majority of the people change the whole atmosphere. If it's majority monks, it's a monk's talk. or it's a nun's talk. So in order to actually to develop the Sangha in whatever place you are, yes, have lay centres and have monk centres, have nun centres, but please don't mix them. Otherwise the monks or the nuns feel they're just janitors, and they just work so hard just so that you can stay there and meditate, and the monks in the end just leave. So monks are just, or nuns, they're like special species, which they need special situations to allow them to grow. And you look in the different monasteries you know in the world, and Bodhinyana Monastery, and I'm saying this because I'm the abbot, Bodhinyana Monastery is a successful monastery. And the reason is the monks there feel that that's their place. They feel it's their home. And that's why monks like to stay there and grow there. So be careful that a monastery should be for the monastics. If you want to go and stay there, of course you can stay there. All you need to do is shave your hair and put on a brown robe. But it is special. So you don't have to eat boiled frog to be a forest monastery. Or drink your urine. But it used to have to be simple. What can be done when the nimitta just comes and goes, comes and goes? Is it because of not enough effort or unskilled? No, it's because of too much effort. If that nimitta keeps coming and then going, it means that you'll keep coming and going. You can't keep still. So shut up and just sit still. If nimitta wants to come, fine, come. If it wants to go, fine, you can go. And then it will stay. So don't try and force that nimitta to stay. You're doing something, which is why your mind is agitated. You send it away. So just let it be, and the nimitta stays. What's the boundary between what I've just been saying and loss of focus when you just dissolve? The reason why you've lost focus, there must be a cause to that. And a cause means you've done something. That you have interfered with the process. The process is a natural process. Happens to everybody. Independent of who you think you are, where you come from. When you start to let go, the mind gets still and things begin to disappear. The reason why the nimitta comes up is because the body's disappeared. And the reason why the body's disappeared is because it's been still. And now you start to agitate things and the body reappears again. You start to hear sounds. You start to think. All that stuff which was still before, you've now turned on again and it's now moving again. You have disturbed the process. So your job, if that nimitta disappears, is because you've interfered, and stop adding to that interference. You know the old story, the four monks having the vow of silence when one sneezed. And one said, bless you. The second said, you've broken your vow of silence. And the third one, ha ha, so have you. And the fourth one said, I'm glad I'm the only one here who can keep quiet. You see, as soon as you say something, you're part of the problem. As soon as you do something, you don't solve the problem, you make it worse. Yeah, that's right. So you don't say anything. You can't do anything. Even saying letting go is doing letting go. It's not letting go of doing. So don't do let go, let go of doing. Basically, you're letting go of the wrong thing. That's one of the most subtle things in this path of meditation. What do you actually let go of? You let go of that controller, that thing which wants to do the letting go, that thing which wants to get the nimitta there stable. That's what you've got to let go of. I call it the controller. Call it the sankhara, the doer. But after a while you get to know that thing. That thing which causes the agitation of the mind, which moves the world. And then when you get rid of that, then you're peaceful. There's one other skillful means of overcoming that doer. There's another little bit of insight. And this bit of insight, again, came from understanding the Pali, because the word for mind, one of the words for mind is mana. And mana comes from the same root as manati, which means to measure. And literally, there is such a close connection between those words. The mind is that which measures. And it's very profound to understand that. And so if you want to stop the mind and keep it still, stop measuring. What we mean by measuring, I don't mean inches, I mean good and bad, still or moving. Stop all of that. When you don't measure anything, you don't compare deep meditation, shallow meditation, still or restless. It means you can't control anything anymore. You can't do anything. Before you do something, you have to measure it. In other words, judge it. And once you've judged it, it's to my liking, not to my liking, it's where I'm supposed to be going, it's not where I'm supposed to be going, it's good enough or it's not good enough. And that makes you work. It causes business. And the reason that came up was, it was a quote which somebody asked me at Nolamara one evening. It was from Lord Kelvin, one of the great scientists who was part of the Industrial Revolution. And he once said, the only way you can control nature, which was part of technology, the only way you can control nature is to learn how to measure her accurately first. And so much of early technology was making sure you had standard weights and measures so you could accurately measure things, and then you could learn how to control nature. And that's where we got our industries from. But the reverse is also profound. If you don't measure things, you can't control nature. You can't control anything. That's why a lot of governments, they want to take censuses, they want to measure you, get all your information. Once they have all your information, then they can control. Without information, without measuring, there's no means of control. In meditation, that means when you stop measuring, good meditation, bad meditation, deep, shallow, you stop measuring. Now, tomorrow, yesterday, all means of control are taken away from you. Which means the mind stops. The mind, that which measures, disappears when you stop measuring. And interesting, it's a very nice little concept. So stop measuring, you know, how good your meditation is, or how deep it is, and how well you've done in this meditation retreat. Stop measuring. And then there's no more business to be done. Then you'll be still. And then your nimitta will become very stable. Since this is the last night of the retreat, could you kindly share with us some unbelievable story about Ajahn Wang, Ajahn Tate, etc.? The unbelievable stories. We know about Ajahn, I don't know, I think got Wong or Wang. Is that Lumpu Wan? He was the one. You should know that story. He became famous because there was a Thai Air Force pilot who was flying, I don't know how many thousand feet. And as he was flying, he passed a cloud with a monk sitting on top of the cloud. He must have been, the monk must have been also going quite fast because this guy was in a jet. And he could see the monk. And of course he was quite disturbed at seeing a monk flying so high without a license. But he knew the coordinates where he were, and when he landed, sort of he went back to that area and he asked around, are there any forest monks in this area? Because forest monks have all these amazing powers. They said, yeah, there's Lumpu Wan, he's in that area. And so the pilot saw him and said, that was him. Recognized him. The monk had been caught flying. That's Lumpu Wan. But remember, if you can levitate, you've got to be very careful. Because one of my favorite stories, I think this is in one of the commentaries, there was once a monk a long time ago, he could levitate. He could fly through the air. Because he was a forest monk. Did lots of meditation, very, very simply. And his problem was someone saw him. Just a forester. And the forester told his friends that there was a holy monk who could fly through the air. And so they went to see him. Yeah, he was flying through the air, went every morning, you know, for his morning exercise, you know, flying around. And of course the villagers were very impressed, and the villagers told the people in town, The reputation soon got to the city, and in the city the king heard about this. The king said, "That's amazing, really is a monk who can levitate. I would like to see this." So he sent his army into the forest, "Bring this monk to see me. I want to see if he can meditate, if he can levitate." So the army, or a few soldiers, went into the forest, found that monk, said, "The king wants you." "No, I don't want to come and see no king. I'm happy living a nice life as a forest, in the forest." And he didn't want to go. So the soldiers went back again, and the king said, "Look, tell that monk I'll plant a few trees, you know, in my palace garden. I'll put a nice little simple hut. I'll even actually get some import some mosquitoes for him so he feels at home." I added that bit onto the story, that's not in the original. And basically make that monk an offer he can't refuse. So this time then more soldiers went and they dragged that monk back. They had a nice place built for him in the king's garden. And the king said, "Look, you know, I want to see people levitate." So the monk levitated, flew through the air. "Oh, wonderful, you really are a holy monk. Please come and live in this little kuti in the forest. It's just the same as living in your forest. But then I can actually make more merit by feeding you every day. And also, I'd like to ask questions of you about Dhamma. I'm really interested in Buddhism and meditation. There's a monk who can really do something. You fly through the air. Can you please stay in my garden?" So the monk said, "Oh, well, it's true. What's the same? A tree is a tree, whether it's in a palace or it's in a forest." So he decided to live in that hut. And it was a very beautiful arrangement for a while. The king would feed him and get lots of merit, and every now and again the king would actually ask him these profound questions, and the monk would give good answers, and the monk was happy to meditate all day and fly around in the morning under the protection of the king. But what happened one day? The monk was having his morning constitutional flight, and the king was busy that day, so he sent one of his daughters, this gorgeous princess, to actually to take the morning meal to this monk. And this monk was just coming into land, and he saw this beautiful princess, and he had just one moment of lust. That's all it takes, one moment of lust, and he'd lost his ability to fly. Crash landing. So be careful, you levitate, just one moment of lust or ill will, and you're down onto the ground straight away, really bruised. And so this monk, he wasn't badly injured, but he took his meal, and as soon as his meal was over, he went back to the forest, saying, "In the city there's just too many temptations." I think it's a lovely story about the monk who crash landed. That's one of the problems. If you can learn how to levitate, you've got to make sure that you've got no lust, otherwise you get too many bruises. And Ajahn Tate, what did Ajahn Tate do? He's a very, very beautiful monk. What's one of his... Oh, they have the Naga, the fireballs. Have any of you seen those fireballs? I think some of you have, haven't they? Fireballs in the Mekong River? Because this is Ajahn Tate in his monastery there on the Pawarana Day, which is a full moon which ends the rains retreats. For years, there's been a ceremony of these fireballs coming out from the River Mekong, going above the ground and exploding in lights, like a fireworks display. It's not sort of a myth, because TV cameras have been there and shot it. And it only happens one day of the year. And it's a full moon day of October. So because it only happens with a moon day, and only in October, and people have investigated, there's no other natural reason for causing that phenomena. And Ajahn Tate always said it was the Nagas. It was a big... A lot of Nagas under that part of the Mekong River, and they always celebrate, or they used to celebrate, the end of the rains retreat with a display, a supernatural display of fireballs. Anyone here seen that? Okay, but it's been pictures of it. I know people have seen it. It's a real thing. So, believable? Unbelievable? Who knows? I know this other story, which was told to me just not so long ago. This is another amazing story. This guy from Perth. Now, he went trekking in the Himalayas. And, you know, like, it's very common these days to have these, you know, treks and go through the mountains and have these guides show this amazing scenery. So he was trekking up in the mountains. I think it was around about Ladakh area somewhere. That's just to the west of Tibet, you know, to the east of Kashmir Valley. And he was a bit sort of heedless. He lost his way. And he lost the main party. And he was very, very lucky because he was completely lost, separated from the main party, you know, in the mountains. It was only fortunate that late in the evening, just before the sun really went down, he saw a building in the distance and went straight for it. It was a monastery. Now, any monastery, we'd always give hospitality to people that are really lost. You know, if you really are lost, and you come in to Bodhinyana Monastery, we'd always give you a bed for the night. But of course, if you've got a car with you, we send you back home. But this, no car, he was trekking, he was really lost. So the abbot led him in and understood what had happened, gave him a bed for the night. But this was when about midnight, he got woken up by this really mysterious sound. It's really weird, but incredibly beautiful. He never heard, he called it music, but it was much more beautiful than music. He never heard this music ever before in his life. And yeah, he'd been to great concerts, he'd heard great musicians, but this was the most beautiful music he'd ever heard. It was like heavenly music, like Deva music, and it was entrancing. And I don't know how long it went on, but he fell into this very, very deep sleep. And when he woke up in the morning, he had his breakfast, and he went to take leave of the abbot and say thank you. He actually mentioned, he said, last night, around midnight, I heard this incredible sound. I'd never heard anything like it. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard. Was I imagining that, or what was it? And the abbot said, oh, that, yeah, you know, that's, I know about that. What was it? And the abbot said, look, I'm sorry, sir. That's the secret of this monastery. I can only tell you if you're a monk. He said, come on, I'm an Australian, you can tell me. And then I said, no, it's one of our rules. I can't tell you unless you're a monk. And no matter what that Australian did, even though he wanted to offer him some money, donation, this abbot, didn't matter about how much money he wanted to offer, this was only a secret for Buddhist monks to know. So he had to go back. And the monk took him to where, you know, he found his party in the local hotel. The monk took him back there, and so he carried on with his trip. When he came back to Australia, he couldn't get this music out of his head. Like it was obviously happened. When you hear something really supernatural, you keep thinking about it. And it became such an obsession to him, eventually he couldn't sleep at night. And he had to go and see his doctor, go to a psychologist, and the psychologist couldn't help him. In the end, there was only one thing to do. After a couple of years of battling with an obsession to find out what this amazing music was, he turned up at that monastery and he begged the abbot again, please let me know what that secret of that supernatural music is. And the abbot said, look, I told you last time, I can't tell you unless you're a monk. So the Australian said, okay, make me a monk, I have to find out. And like our monastery, it takes a couple of years before you can ordain. You've got to go through your basic training. And the abbot said, look, I can't just make you a monk, I have to train you first of all. The Australian said, I don't care, I have to find out what made that sound. It was such an obsession for him. So he entered the training, 1 year as an anagarika, another year as a novice, and finally his ordination day. He was so excited. And after the ordination, of course, the first question he asked, okay, I'm a monk now, tell me. And the abbot said, come to my room just before midnight. I won't just tell you, I'll show you. And so, it's only a few hours more to wait. After about 4 years, what's a couple of hours? So he waited, and that evening he turned up at the abbot's kuti office just before midnight. And the abbot opened up a drawer in his desk and took out a bunch of keys. Very ancient keys. And he led this Australian to a door in the back of his office. You know these Tibetan temples, they're just these huge buildings with lots of corridors, and they're built a long time ago. And he took out this big wooden key out of this big key ring of many keys. And there was this huge wooden door behind a curtain at the back of the abbot's office. And he put that wooden key inside the door and turned it. Probably hadn't been open for a long time, so it really creaked, you know, like these doors creak when they open. It's a very old one. And he opened the wooden door. And as he opened the wooden door, he could start hearing the sound again. And wow, it was just so beautiful. It made him cry. It was so beautiful. And he noticed there was a corridor. At the end of the corridor, there was another door. And they walked towards that second door. This was the iron door. And so the Abba got up out the iron key, turned that, and the door opened. And as it opened, you could hear the music even clearer. And that was just thrilling. It was, his heart was so excited, and it was just throbbing, the most beautiful thing. If you've had deep meditation, this was just like that. The bliss was just so strong. And as he went closer, he saw there was a silver door. And the abbot got Unikes, the silver key, and opened that door. And when he opened that door, it was the clearest ever. But he could see there was one more door left. Of course, that was the golden door. And he could see underneath the door this incredible, beautiful light coming up. And he could hear the sound of this celestial, supernatural music. It was immense. And as they went to the door, the abba got the gold key out. And you could actually see it wasn't just an ordinary gold door. It was studded in jewels. It was an amazing thing to see. And the abbot turned to him and said, "Are you ready? For this, you know, is going to be supernatural, what you're about to see. Are you ready?" And he said, "I waited 4 years for this. Show me." And he opened the door. And there it was. You know what it was? I can't tell you because you're not monks. I'll tell you later. I've told you that one before, it's a good story though. The next question. Can you explain the difference? Can you explain the difference between awakened mind and conditioned mind? Is it different level of consciousness? Now, an awakened mind, you're awakened to the fact your mind's conditioned. So even though you're awakened, you're still conditioned. It's just you're awakened to the fact you're conditioned. So you don't bother about your mind again. It's not my mind, it's made by other people. So every time I tell silly jokes like that, I don't feel guilty about telling silly jokes as a monk. It's my dad's fault, because he told me jokes. So my mind is conditioned, but I'm awakened to the fact that, you know, it's not my fault. So a suicide bomber would meet its creator and bliss, would it? Oh, of course not. It doesn't matter what people believe. You know, sometimes, you know, if you're a suicide bomber, you know, and you sort of believe what we call revealed truth, and people tell you this is what's going to happen. Listen, now, after sort of doing something terrible like that, you're right there afterwards. You see the carnage, you see the tears and the suffering you've caused. What will that do to you? You know, when you realize that you've been the cause of so much real pain and suffering with people. There's something we call conscience and guilt. And everybody has that. I remember just going teaching in prisons. And there are some of these prisoners have done horrendous crimes, and they'd be swaggering through the jail as if they'd done nothing. And I thought that maybe people don't have conscience until I got to know those prisoners, and they say, "This is just how we have to behave in jail." But when they got to know you, and they were honest with you, they say, "We feel so bad about what we've done." The swagger and the denial was just how they presented themselves to other prisoners. When you befriended them, and they trusted you, and it opened up. And all these prisoners who you thought had no guilt or remorse at all had terrible pain and suffering. And that actually really showed me that the remorse, regret about the bad things we've done, we can't hide them, they're there. We can deny it to other people, but we can't deny it to ourselves. So a person who's done a suicide bombing, who's hurt so many people, that's right in front of them after they die. They can't deny that. The amount of guilt and pain which they must feel having hurt and killed so many people, that would send them to hell. That would send them to a really terrible rebirth. So a suicide bomber will not go to a bliss. It just cannot work that way. If you understand how the mind works, no way that they're going to really suffer. Dear Ajahn Brahm, a big thank you to you and the organizing committees for this excellent meditation retreat conducted for us. Facilities are outstanding. Yeah, I see many of you outstanding in the rain. Food is excellent. Environment is conducive. Hope you and your committee could forgive us if we have somehow offended the retreat centre rules or any one of you. Now you mention it. No, the rules are just guidelines. The rules are there for you. You're not there for the rules. So in other words, you make use of these with peace, with kindness, with gentleness. They're guidelines for you. You don't have to keep them. But you want to keep them. You see the reason for them. And that's why that doesn't matter how many police blitzes there are trying to keep the speed limits or not going through red cameras or red lights or wearing your seatbelt. Doesn't matter how many times you make rules and how much penalties you have for breaking the rules. People will not keep them unless they want to keep them, unless they realize the reason for keeping these rules. So it's a waste of time me telling you have to do this, you have to do that. What's most important is you want to keep, you see the reason for them. They help your meditation, they help keep a smooth retreat centre, they make it sure it's there for people after you leave. So just cleaning your room up tomorrow, or washing your sheets if you didn't bring them yourself. These are things which are obvious to do. You do this because you want other people to make use of this place afterwards. So you know the rules are just obvious once you see them, so after a while you don't need the rules. You just need to be wise and compassionate, and that's all the rules you need. Did your mum tell you that you had a good temperament as a child? When was the last time you got angry or lost your temper with someone and for what? Who asked that question? Did I have a good temperament as a child? I was just an ordinary kid. But you know, sometimes people think that you were born. Born a monk. Oh no, my mum did tell me I was bald when I came out of her womb. That must have been a good sign. But I remember some years ago, Angie came and stayed at Bodhinyana Monastery. And again, she was a bit restless. And so instead of meditating, she was in our library looking around something to distract herself. And so she picked out a talk by Ajahn Brahm about 20 years earlier, when I first started giving talks. And she listened to it, and she came and told me afterwards, "That was the worst and most boring talk I've ever heard in my whole life," she said. And she laughed, she said, "'Cause I've seen how much you've changed." You know, you do grow as a monk, you grow in the robes. Each one of you has changed since I met you, which is a wonderful thing, to show you're not born enlightened, you grow enlightened. So when you go back and say, "Well, did your mother tell you had a good temperament as a child?" I was a stupid child as anybody else. What sort of stupid things did I do as a kid? I don't know, I did many stupid things. I'm trying to remember some of the most stupid things I did. Oh, I remember one of the stupid things I did as a kid. It was my mother's birthday. I must have been about 7 or 8 years of age. It was her birthday, so I decided to get her a special present. In London at that time, there was like an East End dish called eels and mashed potatoes. No, like eels and mashed potatoes. That was a speciality in East London. And it became a speciality in the whole of London. It was just a craze, you know, eel and mash. It had shops, not fish and chip shops, but eel and mash shops. So it was my mother's birthday, so I went to the shop and asked for an eel, a live one. And I wrapped it up in birthday paper. And using all the self-control which a 7-year-old could do, I gave it to my mummy. "Happy birthday, mummy." And she said, "Oh, how sweet, my kid has offered me a nice, I wonder what is it?" And she opened it. This eel rose up. That's the sort of 7-year-old I was. Oh, poor old mother. That's one of the things which I remembered. So obviously I wasn't born as a monk. So imagine, Can you talk a little on being at peace with pain and death and other skillful means? P.S. Why Brahma Wangsa? That was given to me by my preceptor, because those of you in Thai was at his time, it's Somdet Buddhajan now, at that time it's called Chalkun Prom. Prom means Brahma. So he gave me like the lineage, the family of Brahma, so the lineage of my preceptor. That's what it really meant, Brahma Wangsa. So it's Brahma is what you could say these days. So being at peace with pain and death are other skillful means, but sometimes there will be some pains which you cannot get rid of. And the more you try and get rid of them, the more they hurt. And those are the types of pains we call, now in that simile, anger-eating demons. The more you don't want them, the worse they get. And if you don't know that simile, open the door of your heart. It's in there, I'm sure you know that simile, anger-eating demon. If you give it anger, I don't want you, get out of here, it gets worse. If you don't give it anger, but give it kindness, demon, the door of my heart's open to you, thank you so much for visiting me. And the demon gets smaller, and each smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And many pains are like that. When you say, get out of my body, you don't belong, get out of here pain, get out of here sickness, it makes it worse. When you say, welcome pain, welcome sickness, because pain is an anger-eating demon, when you feed anger, it gets worse. So that's why that sibling was a very powerful sibling. And that's not Ajahn Brahm sibling or Ajahn Chah, that's the Buddha sibling, it's in Udala, the sibling of the anger-eating demon. Powerful sibling. Which shows that when you give anger to something, it doesn't get rid of the problem, but it actually makes the problem worse. And much of pain is anger-eating demon. So if you want to get rid of the pain, read that anger-eating demon simile. You mentioned Buddha passed away in the fourth jhana. Please share with us, in what way did the people surrounding him know Buddha passing away in fourth jhana? It was only one mind. Aniruddha was encompassing the Buddha's mind with his own mind, and actually could see the Buddha was passing away in fourth jhana. So remember, some monks have got very powerful minds, and they can actually almost like resonate and know what the other mind is doing. And that's what Aniruddha had, great psychic powers. Does Nimitta stay from the fourth jhana? Nimitta stays through from first jhana to the fourth jhana. No, the Nimitta stage actually, if you ask yourself when you're in jhana, what are you watching? You're watching the bliss. The Nimitta has disappeared. And why has it disappeared? It's because that light is not moving. And the mind only can notice things which move. It has vanished. But what's left is the bliss. That's what I meant with Lewis Carroll's simile of the Cheshire Cat vanishing, leaving only the smile. Just bliss without anything to notice the bliss, or anything for the bliss to be played out on. No screen of attention, just bliss. That's why these states are very weird and very subtle. When we say nimitta, does it only mean the bright light, or can it be other things as well, e.g. a picture or an image? You can say a picture or an image, those are the complicated nimittas. When you see like fields, or you see houses, or you see people, or you see the Buddha or something, that's a complex nimitta, and it's not simple and focused enough to take you into the jhanas. So if you do see a picture of a Buddha, or see a picture of a tree or whatever, there is a trick, which is to focus on that part of that image which is the most beautiful. You can't do that at the time, but because I've said that, often you will do that as an automatic response. It may be the Buddha's nose is shiny or something, or maybe there's a dewdrop on the tip of a leaf. The mind focuses on that, then a real simple nimitta can come up, just a simple bright light. It has to be simple in order to take you into jhana. Complex nimittas, trees and stuff, is just too complicated. It won't take you into the jhanas. Out of respect, this is to take my doubt away from my way. Do you know any person who is fully enlightened in present days? Arahat, so on, lots of them, Sakadagami, many, Anagami, more than one. If I told you, would you believe me? If you did, you're stupid, because how do you know that what I'm saying is true? Isn't it the case not to believe other people, but to find out for yourself? Ahi pasiko, pachatamwe titabo winyuhi. You're not supposed to rely on a teacher, but find out for yourself. So if you say, yes, Ajahn Brahm, if you tell me that you'll believe me, that's being stupid. And if I told you and you didn't believe me, it's a waste of time me telling you. That's a good way of getting out of answering your question. Yeah, there are people who are enlightened these days, but who are they? Do you want to know? I'm not telling. And there's a reason for not telling. And the reason for not telling, you all know the reason for not telling, I hope, because you've listened to the stories before. If you say that, say Santuti is...